Norman Lewis versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin. Timothy Aiken arguing for plaintiffs Nora Norman and Dolores Lewis. Mr. Aiken.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Tim Aiken. I represent the petitioner, and I'm reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. If it pleases the court, the Court of Appeals decided this case because it felt that Furman did not address the issue of vicarious liability. That is simply not a fair reading of the case. At 655, Justice Gordon says, the problem of holding one medical doctor liable for another's conduct has often received judicial attention. And he goes on for the next page and a half to explain the various ways that one doctor is held liable for that conduct of another. And then he ultimately says, as in somewhat of a dissent, he said, to hold Dr. Smurl, paren, the assistant, close paren, is liable for the negligence of Dr. McConnell, paren, the surgeon in charge, close paren, would seem to be the application of a novel doctrine of respondeat inferior. So there is no question that Furman versus Smurl dealt with holding one person responsible in the operating theater for the conduct of another because they are jointly working on the patient. Similarly, in Morrill versus Kaminsky, Justice Fairchild, the only dissenter, dissented because he said it is quite clear that both Dr. Kaminsky and Mrs. Morrill, the injured party, placed their reliance on Dr. Bump. And it seems clear to me, says Justice Fairchild, from the evidence that Dr. Bump assumed responsibility for the treatment, including the diagnosis and putting on the cast. Dr. Kaminsky made it plain that he did not want Mrs. Morrill to rely on his judgment, and with her consent, he appealed to Dr. Bump. So even in that situation, however, the court rejected the idea that Dr. Morrill would not be vicariously liable to the plaintiff because, again, there was active continued participation. Thus, it seems clear in this state, at least up to this point in time, that the law is that a doctor who remains in continued active participation with a patient is responsible for those people who work with him in that operation. I submit that that is not only the law, but that it's fair.
Can I just a question? If that's the case, and in this case, you can correct me if I'm wrong, these nurses were employed by, quote, the hospital.
Yes, sir.
There was a responsibility of a nurse to count the sponges. Are you saying, I mean, under the theory that I think you're advancing, that the doctors would be held liable under the quote captain of the ship or liability for an act of someone who says it was done? In other words, how would the doctor know that in this case, as I understand, the sponges were all accounted for?
Well, they thought they were all accounted for.
Well, I'm just saying, but what would you expect the doctor to do?
I have two answers to that question. One is, the doctor is the one who puts the sponges in, and the doctor is the one who takes them out. There's an old case by the name of Peril, which is in 177 WIS, where this is discussed, and although it may be the custom or even the obligation of the nurses to count the sponges, in Peril they said that does not necessarily relieve the doctor. However, in that case, the sponge had been left in by another doctor, another surgery, so it didn't apply. That's my first answer. My second answer...
But before you... In this case, as I understand it, you stipulated that the doctor was not negligent.
That's true.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, in answer to Justice Wilcox's question, that he couldn't have done anything. He is the one that put him in. He is the one to take him out. But my second answer to the question is, it doesn't matter if he could do anything. Under theories accepted by this court in the past, in Pamperin, this court accepted that a hospital is liable for the acts of an emergency room physician, who it does not control, the acts of a radiologist in Kishishan, the driver of an automobile, if you're the owner of the automobile. We quote another case where someone was carrying water across the sidewalk. principles as quoted in Prosser at page 21 of our brief. This is sometimes called imputed negligence. More often it is called vicarious liability, or the principle is given the Latin name respondeat superior. We tend to think of respondeat superior only being a term, and our brief sort of implies that this is how we were thinking of it at one point, as only being a term that applies to employer-employee situations. That's not the case. In fact, in the automobile case that we cite to the court, which isn't at my fingertips at this moment, the court makes clear you don't even need clear agency. So the question of vicarious liability, Justice Wilcox, is never what the person could do about it. Because if one of my employees is on an errand for me running to the courthouse to file a complaint and gets an accident, there's nothing I can do about the fact that he inadvertently goes through a red light. I mean, the plaintiff does not have to prove that I hired a bad driver or a bad employee. I'm still responsible for that employee's conduct. That's the nature of vicarious liability.
In this case, the nurses are not the employee of the doctor, are they? They're the employee of the employees of the hospital.
True.
And that seems to be a fairly significant distinction.
Well, it is a significant distinction, because if they were the employees of the doctor, we wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. However, given the case of Furman versus Smurl and the Morrill case, I still say the law is clear, because Dr. Bump was not the employee of Dr. Kaminsky. As a matter of fact, as I read in Justice Fairchild's dissent, it's quite clear that it was to the contrary, which is why in the later case of Furman versus Smurl, Justice Gordon refers to it as respondeat inferior, where the doctor who is referring can be held liable. But I'm not sure that that's anything but good, because if we're going to have two people acting on a person who's under anesthesia, why should the doctor who was retained, the doctor who controls where the surgery is going to occur, the doctor who is in charge of the operating theater, as I happen to mention this case to my wife, she says, well, they certainly act like captains. Why aren't they captains?
Is that an independent analysis?
That's an independent, not legal analysis, but I thought it was noteworthy.
Do you have a cite for that?
Yeah.
I guess, counsel, it seems when we've done some research on this that the trend is to move away from what you're advocating for the state of Wisconsin, and that is this captain of the ship or taking total responsibility.
Well,
in this case, as Justice Babich referred to, it kind of belies what happened here when the nurses worked for someone else. So what you're saying, regardless of the situation of how they were employed, that the doctor always would be, quote, responsible.
Well, in the operating theater, that certainly should be true. But I want to make clear, this is not like the broad captain of the ship doctrine. This is when professionals are in active participation of the case. We have established case law. Whether or not this court wants to change that case law is, of course, something I oppose, but is the court's power. But why would the court change it here? Captain of the ship has been applied where someone comes in, even to an emergency room, has rushed the surgery, and a doctor is called in and operates, and the nurse is called in, and the doctor is charged with the nurse's conduct. That may be unfair, but it isn't unfair here, where the patient has gone to the doctor and asked the doctor's advice and asked him to complete his professional duty, and the doctor recommends surgery and picks out the hospital and the operating room and takes the patient to that room. Otherwise,
who selected the nurses?
The hospital selected the nurses, but the doctor selected the hospital.
Okay. So now, do you want the doctor to be vicariously liable for the hospital?
No. Not, but
why shouldn't that be your theory? It should be that the doctor has made the selection of the hospital. The hospital selected the nurse. The hospital is negligent in selecting the hospital is liable for the nurse's negligence. The doctor's liable for the hospital negligence.
Yes, and as you corrected yourself, Madam Justice, the hospital was not negligent in the selection
right.
of nurses.
It was all responding at superior. So why don't you get it all the way up? Because if you were in an industrial situation, the plant supervisor looks over the worker, and ultimately the company is liable. even though you've got Spondiat Superior all the way down the line?
Because in the operating theater, it's not as attenuated as that. As I said, the doctor is putting the sponges in, the doctor is taking the sponges out. As a matter of fact, the doctor is in charge of what sponges go in and what go out.
Why wasn't the doctor negligent? Didn't take out all the sponges?
The reasons for the stipulation of no negligence was because the nurses were primarily responsible for that. And the fact is that we had established Wisconsin case law that held that two professionals who are in active participation on a patient under anesthesia, there's vicarious liability.
Well, that's the one of the doctor cases where they said, in effect, that the two were acting jointly. So whether they were acting under each other, that they were acting jointly, that was good enough. That's your theory.
That's my theory, and as I said in Morrill, it's quite clear that Dr. Kaminsky didn't even want to be involved anymore, and he was held jointly liable. The same thing is true in Furman. Dr. Smurl was basically off the case, and Justice Fine is just plain wrong in the way he read that decision. It's clear from Justice Gordon's comments that this is respondeat superior / inferior, and that we're talking about holding one doctor responsible for another. And the reason it's fair is because the patient has gone to the doctor and the patient is under anesthesia. The ramifications of saying that the doctor and all those operating together in the operating theory aren't jointly or vicariously liable is that if that rule is abolished, then when the patient gets injured, the patient is going to have to identify necessarily in every case who the responsible party is. And if they can't, so sad, too bad.
No, you just would have the hospital liable. Your problem in this case is that you've got a municipal hospital and you've got a maximum in the statute. If you had a non-municipal hospital,
I wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. That's your problem. So the problem you have is for a peculiar fact situation. But the law that you're asking is much broader than that.
No, I think this court should look at the broader ramifications of withdrawing the case law. Yes, my case is very specific and a very specific problem. But as soon as you withdraw this joint or vicarious responsibility theory, which is established in our case law, now when the patient's under anesthesia and a mishap occurs, let's say the patient wakes up with an arm that's dead. I have cases like that. And is it the anesthesiologist who put the arm wrong? Is it the operating surgeon who pinched a nerve with a clamp? Is it the nurses who failed to move the patient often enough? And now, if you change the rule of law, these patients will have no method of recovery. They're under anesthesia. They won't be able to show. Whereas the truth of the matter is, vicarious liability says, you don't have to identify the exact person who is responsible. So that when you change something like this in this medical area, you do more than just identify my little situation with a municipal hospital vicarious liability. You change a whole ramification of things that go on in the operating theater where the patient has no ability to produce the required identification of party.
Mr. Reagan, aren't you in the examples that you're giving us now really talking about a res ipsa situation, which is very different than what we're dealing with here?
No, not necessarily. You may be able to identify the injury that occurred, but not who did it. You may be able to be very specific about how the injury occurred, but not who did it.
Well, in Furman, they were certainly talking about the fact that the injury to the patient would not have occurred without negligence by one of the two doctors. And certainly there was a extensive discussion of res ipsa in that particular case.
But Dr. Smurl was not found responsible under res ipsa. Dr. Smurl was found responsible under vicarious liability. In fact, the jury came out and said, are we to find Dr. Smurl responsible for Dr. Dr. McDonald's negligence? And the jury was told, yes, you are. So although, yes, it is respondeat, it is res ipsa, and I'm referring to a situation that arguably could be res ipsa, I've never taken in 26 years of doing medical negligence law to a jury a res ipsa case, nor would I want to. They're hard enough as they are. I'm talking about identifying the defendant who did the harm, which in this state is still a necessary fact, except if you have vicarious liability, in which event, let the guilty parties decide who's responsible.
Mr. Aiken, how many people were in the operating room?
I don't know the precise number, but one would suppose the doctor and at least two nurses and an anesthesiologist. But the anesthesiologist may well have left, because once the patient's under, somebody else can monitor.
Suppose there was a second doctor, not the lead surgeon, but a second doctor. Could that person have been vicariously liable too?
Sure, because if he was in active participation under our case law, yes. And why not? Because the patient's the innocent party here. So now, if the doctors don't like the fact that when the nurses do something wrong, they're held responsible, they can either supervise more closely, they can count the sponges themselves, or they can make sure that the parties that they decide to operate, the places they decide to operate on, have financial responsibility such that the claims can be met. Why is the innocent patient stuck with the loss? That's what's going to happen if you change the existing case law, as between two allegedly innocents, the doctor and the patient who was under, the patient suffers if you change. Right now, I grant, the doctor suffers. And under any vicarious liability situation, the innocent party suffers. It's always the same. There is no proof that anybody does anything wrong as far as the person who's responsible, be it the employer, be it the owner of the car with the driver, be it the person who let someone carry water over the sidewalk, be it pampering, or be it a radiologist, be it an emergency room physician. All those situations, the party held responsible is innocent. It's a whole different case if you can show they did something negligent in the hiring. But it's an innocent party. In fact, the hospital's innocent here. Their nurses was the one who was fault. Why shouldn't she pay? Why should we pass it up the road to the hospital? It's no more silly to say we can't pass it to the doctor and say, well, let's not pass it to the hospital either. Why should we have such a rule? The nurses can carry insurance, and if they don't have it, too bad.
How do we decide who is the person who is vicariously liable in the operating room? Could it have been the anesthesiologist who's a physician, stayed there all the time? Is he or she responsible for the nurse?
If the anesthesiologist would fulfill the definitions of the cases, active participation in the cure and treatment, I suppose so.
Well, I think that there's some people who think maybe the most important person in that room is the anesthesiologist.
I don't share that belief, but that's okay.
That's the next case.
Well, maybe. I never know when my next case is.
Careful.
I'll argue that case when I get to it.
That's right. Well, let's just look at it for the moment. There could have been two surgeons.
There sure could have been.
So how do you pick the one you're going to say is the... I know you don't like the analogy or the phrase, the captain of the ship, or is the lead person to whom everyone else is responsible, or for whom he or she is responsible? How do you pick them?
Well, the court could redefine Morrill and Furman in the other cases we cite and say, we want to limit Morrill and Furman to captain the ship so that other physicians in the operating theater would not be held liable. That could be another step the court would take.
You could say the hospital has to designate someone, then that person has a little star on the lab coat.
I was in the military for 6 years, and that's the type of star I had pinned to my forehead. It didn't matter who else did something wrong. That's the burden of leadership. And the doctor is the one who's in charge. The doctor is the one whose services were sought. We can carry it further. What if the doctor decides to do this on an outpatient basis in a walk-in center, and he hires an independent nursing association be his nurses in order to, so he could make more money, let's say. He's not going to be liable. Or maybe I start hiring outside paralegals from a paralegal association. I pay them, not them, and I say, it's not my responsibility, statute ran, the paralegal blew it. At some point in our law of professional negligence, the buck has to stop somewhere. And I don't think it's any more illogical to say the doctor, who's the captain of that operating theater, that's where the buck stops, than to say the buck stops at the hospital's door. Because nurses are independent professionals. They carry insurance. Yep. Why are hospitals so responsible? Just because the nurses work there. That's the only reason.
When we talk about the buck stopping, aren't there Wisconsin regulations that say that the nurses are responsible under the Venn code. I may be mistaken, but there are regulations that say that the nurses are responsible.
Well, it says that the nurses are responsible
for the sponge pads.
According to hospital policy, yes. But just because one party is responsible doesn't mean, for example, the driver of my employee driving my automobile, he's responsible under Wisconsin statute to stop at a red light. If he doesn't, I don't get to say, well, you can't stick me with that negligence. I mean, he went through a red light, for goodness sakes. So I don't think there's any difference here. If you're suing me because my driver went through the red light, you're not saying I did something wrong. You don't have to prove I did something wrong. And the fact that he violated a Wisconsin safety statute by going through a red light wouldn't make any difference either. So I think those are distinctions without differences. The only question is do you want to abandon a principle or limit a principle that's been established in this state for at least 50, if not 60 or 70 years, and there's good reasons for not abandoning it be above and beyond this case, and I think it's dangerous not to then just say, well, because this case looks so simple, let's abandon it. You're opening up a Pandora's box that's much broader than is covered in any of the briefing or I think would have been covered normally in the arguments.
Help me with this, if you will. The captain of the ship doctrine, you might not like that phraseology, but as you said, it was 50, 60 years ago, and then in the 40s, as I understand it, the courts developed this doctrine in response to the charitable immunity of hospitals. So you have an innocent patient who suffers injury by reason of the hospital negligence or staff negligence of nurses. The injured person couldn't recover because of this charitable immunity. So this doctrine of the captain of the ship evolved, as I understand it. Your facts really have the same underlying rationale. Because you have here a municipal hospital which enjoys immunity, parallel to charitable immunity. But the concept goes to the private pay and to private hospitals as well as to the public, and that concerns me. So help me address that, because the rationale I see is the same for the development of that doctrine here, but uniquely because you are capped by the immunity, the limit.
I think that although the primary reason may have been because of charitable immunity of hospitals, I dispute that that's the only rationale for the rule, any more than when this court in Kashishian and Pamperin developed rules of vicarious liability, that was the primary purpose. The real purpose for rules like this is that the patient is the helpless one who is under anesthesia and has no control or knowledge of what's going on around him. And yet if he gets injured, if the law isn't as it is right now, either as it is or modified to be purely captain of the ship so it's more narrow, you have now forced the patient to identify the negligent party, even if he can identify the injury. And that isn't an easy thing when a patient's under and all the witnesses are all part of the same gang. And that is something, if you look at the cases involving captain ship, is often the case, as is this idea that we're trying to get around charitable immunity. And the idea that captain ship has been thrown out, I don't accept either. There are courts that have reviewed it and thrown it out. There are courts that have reviewed it that haven't. The question is, have those courts taken into consideration the problem I'm addressing to this court, that it isn't as simple as who collects money? It's whether or not patients or doctors and nurses have to identify what goes on in an operating theater. And also, I submit that since the doctor is the one in charge, if he doesn't like the charitable immunity aspects, he should get the hospital to waive it. And then he wouldn't have to worry about these issues. But he's the one who selects everything. And we don't know all the reasons why doctors may select one hospital versus another, okay? But it has to do with patient load. It has to do with where they can get privileges. It has to do with closeness to their house. There's all sorts of things they factor in when they select this hospital. There's no reason why they can't say, look, you're going to waive hospital immunity if I'm going to be responsible. I'm not going to accept that. But one thing we know for sure, the patient's helpless. And what it concerns me about any change in the law is that we're very concerned about the physician being held responsible because he's allegedly innocent, although he has a lot of control here. But we're not concerned about the fact, if we abolish this rule, about the patient who is absolutely innocent. And it doesn't have to be an injury as simple as this. I have cases that are operating in theater where there's quadriplegia. And we would have to then start identifying who caused the quadriplegia. Was it bad positioning? Was it an anesthetic accident? Was it the doctor having a drill slip when no one can identify? So I think that there are many reasons for captainship above and beyond collectability. It just happens that in this case, collectability is so, and it also happens because we have a patient's compensation fund that's the big umbrella carrier for them all. So if there wasn't this municipal liability, the hospital wouldn't have to pay anyway. But every situation of vicarious liability involves, I think, instead of spreading the load, involves saying the innocent, the most innocent, shouldn't have to meet this burden and shouldn't have to suffer the loss. And I recognize that there has been a trend not only in this state, but in all across the country in legislatures to stick the loss to the injured party. And obviously, what I do for a living, I severely object to that concept. I think it's wrong.
Thank you. Justice Prosser.
Suppose we did not have a municipal hospital. We had the same facts. And we had your theory. How would you apportion the liability among the doctor?
0-100. If we had to, that's why when one of the justices raised the problem, what if this rule would apply to non-municipal hospitals, it would apply legally, but practically it would have no effect because the hospital has unlimited insurance, just like the doctors do. So the doctor would say, okay, I'm vicariously liable, but in the real, in the analysis of who's actually negligent, I have no responsibility. You pay the whole load, which is the beauty of the way this case was set up so it could come to the courts, because the doctor clearly could collect entirely against the hospital.
How can he say it's no liability or no responsibility? We're just putting it on him if we follow you, and his hands are as clean in this as the hospital's.
He's got no negligence. He has no negligence, so under theories of comparative negligence, he would not have to pay. Under theories of vicarious liability, he does. The same issue exists under...
So your answer has to be that they have to share it in some way.
No. It's just like under Pamperin and Kishishin, the radiologist and the emergency room doctor have unlimited insurance. The hospital never ultimately pays that load, although they're responsible under vicarious liability. They never pay it. Ultimately, the emergency room doctor's insurance pays it, if he has insurance, which he's supposed to, and it's unlimited, or the radiologist's insurance pays it, and he's supposed to, and it's unlimited. So the hospital never pays. Hospitals pay for nurses because the nurses usually don't have independent insurance as part of their employment. But otherwise, they never pay under these vicarious liability situations. Nor would the doctor here. Unless for some reason the hospital's municipal or the hospital hasn't paid its fund coverage, but that's easy for doctors to see into. They're members of the staff. They have staff privileges. They know what goes on. They actually help run the hospital. So the idea that this rule of law would extend and somehow hurt physicians and their insurance is just not true. Because there's joint responsibility, vicarious liability, but there's not joint negligence. That's how this case got stipulated.
So the situation is that there is no comparison. There's two sources of recovery for the plaintiff to look to, depending upon the level of damages.
Right.
How it actually works.
And if we look to the doctor can sue the hospital. Every dime I paid, you owe.
Right. If I could ask one follow-up question, too. Mr. Aiken, you keep referring to if we abolish this rule. As I read this case, this isn't about whether to abolish the rule of the Fairman case, but whether or not to extend it.
Well, I couldn't disagree more. I mean, Furman, Justice Gordon says, right, the problem of holding one medical doctor liable for another's conduct has often received judicial attention. This court has considered the problem a number of cases and quotes all the cases we refer to. Later, he says, to hold Dr. Smurl, the assistant, liable for the negligence of Dr. McDonald, not for his own negligence, for Dr. McDonald's negligence, the surgeon in charge, would seem to be an application of a novel doctrine of respondeat inferior. And that's why I so severely object to Justice Fine's decision. His decision is just a plain wrong reading of Furman v. Smurl and also ignores Morrill, where Justice Fairchild in his dissent says this was a clear abdication of responsibility by Dr. Kaminsky and an assignment of that responsibility to Dr. Bump.
Well, we can't read Morrill by reference to the dissent, though. The majority opinion in Morrill clearly said both doctors have liability for negligence because of their conduct in this case.
Well,
so whatever spin the dissent put on the decision, I mean, that case is clearly different because the majority opinion there said both doctors were negligent. There's sufficient evidence to prove that both doctors were negligent.
I don't agree with that reading more. I agree that there was an offhand statement that said, besides Dr. Kaminsky, you could have checked the cast too. But we don't know if there was any medical proof that Dr. Kaminsky was held liable for not checking the cast. We know he was held liable under vicarious liability. And I agree the last sentence makes that offhand reference, but that wasn't, the dissent is reciting the facts of the case as they appear in the record, and the facts of the case are he referred it out and that he wasn't supposed to have any more responsibility, including checking the cast. He was just going to do what Dr. Bump told him to do. So the primary holding of Morrill is vicarious liability. So this case is not an extension. This case, I think you either have to reverse what you're calling the captain of the ship, which I think is unwise for the reason I stated, or this case is more inside the facts of those cases because the nurse is an inferior. She's not even a court. In this case, the inferior was held responsible for the superior, both in Morrill and in Furman. The inferior was held responsible. Now we're asking for the superior to be held responsible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken. Mr. Roy, representing Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Reardon. I'm representing Dr. Saldera, Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. As you're aware from Mr. Aiken's argument, we're here because he's arguing that Dr. Saldera is vicariously liable for the negligent acts of a surgical tech and a circulating nurse. He's not arguing that these negligent acts are imputed to Dr. Saldera because of the doctrine of respondeat superior or borrowed servant, but only that Dr. Saldera participated actively in a surgery. And he's basing this decision or this theory on the Furman versus Smurl case and its predecessors, Heimlich versus Harvey and Morrill versus Kaminsky.
What do you understand to be the elements of vicarious or respondeat superior?
I believe that
you're saying he's not doing the respondeat superior.
Right.
Okay,
I think
so tell me what are the elements of respondeat superior?
I believe that the employer, you must have an employer who's employing the employee, who controls the actions of the employee. So therefore, you can impute the negligent actions of the employee back to the employer because the employer is paying that employee, is supervising the employee's activities, and not only supervising the activities, but supervising the manner in which the activities are done.
Counsel,
I'm sorry, just going to have to stand in front of the
I'm board. Sorry, I have a problem.
I'm looking at Prosser and Keaton on torts, and I may be wrong because I'm doing this quickly, but it seems to me that employment relationship isn't necessary, but that there be some relationship existing between A and B.
Correct, an agency relationship or a borrowed servant relationship. But this is all covered by the existing Wisconsin law that we have. Mr. Aiken is arguing now that we implement new law to cover this situation.
So, when you responded to my question that for respondeat superior, an element of that is employment, would you rephrase that? Because apparently that's wrong. Tell me what you understand. I mean, is it control? Is it what are the elements of respondeat superior?
The main element of respondeat superior is control, and that is control of the duties, the management in the way the duties are performed by the employee or the agent.
Well,
of the master.
Do you need employee-employer relationship for respondeat superior?
you can have that, that is
you
part of
it.
You
don't need it, okay. So that's what I'm trying to get. That's what it is, a special relationship using, that's not the right word, but control, right?
Correct.
So that's what we're looking at, not whether someone gets a paycheck from someone else, but whether or not A has control over B. Now tell me if I'm wrong on that, because I want what your view is.
Getting a paycheck is part of it, but...
But it's not a necessary
part. Necessary.
Okay. What
the necessary
is
element is the control of the employee's or agent's duties, and the control and the manner in which that employee takes care of those duties.
That
it's not just saying...
That person, not employee.
Right.
That's what I'm getting at.
It's not just saying, go do this.
Uh-huh.
It's go do this, and I'm going to tell you how it's supposed to be done.
So if I meddle and tell some driver on the street how to back up, and because I'm trying to be helpful, and in doing so, he smashes into something because I have not done it properly. Would I be liable for that?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, you don't have the agency relationship with that person, which is they're not performing a duty for you. You're just telling them how to park a car. You may be negligent, like those cases are when you wave somebody through an intersection, but not on an agency or responding at superior
principle. I'd be liable
principle.
For my own negligence.
Correct, for waving the individual through. As we talked about in this particular instance, Mr. Aiken referred to the Morell versus Kaminsky case as indicating that there is this vicarious liability that is relied on in the Furman versus Smurl case. Now, in my reading of the case, we have a woman who's injured, her arm is injured, she goes into Dr. Kaminsky. He looks at her, calls in two other doctors, Dr. Wright, Dr. Bump, and asks them to help him treat this woman. Now, what they do in this case is they examine the x-rays and decide on a treatment together as a whole. And the problem in this case is that the court could not decide who is negligent when this woman came out and said, listen, I can't straighten my arm out anymore. So the court said there's no way they could figure out individual liability, so determined that the doctors were jointly liable. And I think Justice Crooks hit on it when we talked about the idea of res ipsa loquitur. And what we have in this case, like Morell, is we have three doctors who are jointly taking exclusive control of this patient's health, coming up with a treatment plan after reviewing the x-rays, implementing that treatment plan, which was negligent, causing this woman injury. Now, if you take the res ipsa loquitur doctrine and apply that to this case, which it seems to be looking like, is that there's a presumption of negligence on all three, and they've got to rebut that presumption. They're jointly negligent. All three are negligent. In the case we have presently today, Lewis, Dr. Sildara is not negligent. The plaintiffs have stipulated that. So this is not similar to Morell. What we have in Morell is a case where there really is no vicarious liability, but joint liability because they can't figure out who was negligent. Now there's a case, Fumfredo versus, I think, McLean, which sets forth this proposition in which two doctors who were operating on the same patient caused some kind of injury to the patient. They couldn't figure out which doctor did it, but they determined since both those doctors had exclusive control of that patient and they couldn't divide up the negligence, that both were jointly negligent or presumed negligent, and they would have to rebut that presumption. So I don't think Morell has anything to do with this case or vicarious liability as set forth by Mr. Aiken.
If these nurses were hired by the doctor, I take it we wouldn't be here either.
That's true, and I would agree with the fact that we wouldn't be here if this wasn't a cap problem also.
Yeah, so you are asking for a rule, essentially, that the doctor is liable only for his actions and anybody under his direct control or employment, but not beyond that.
Correct. I think what we can do is use the existing laws that we have in Wisconsin today to determine liability. We have the direct liability, which Mr. Aiken talked about. I mean, if he was concerned with the doctor removing the lap pads. You could have sued him directly.
Okay, I think I understand exactly what the rule that you're asking for, and Mr. Aiken's asking for the opposite rule, that the doctor is vicariously liable for people in that operating room. Now, when we look at these kind of dueling rules that are contrary to each other, we always look then at the policy, at the results that follow from these rules. It strikes me that if you should prevail, then there is absolutely no incentive, and in fact a great deal of negative incentive, for the doctor to make sure that the people that work with him are financially responsible. If you should lose and Mr. Aiken should win, then the doctor has an incentive to make sure that the people that are working with him are financially responsible. Now, that's how I perceive this right now. What's wrong with that, or what am I not taking into account?
I think that you have to look at the people who are responsible for these individuals. We have the hospital. The hospital has a financial responsibility or interest in having their nurses or technicians do their job. They're not going to have people in there who can't do the job well, because their reputation will go down the tubes. So I don't think you have to place that responsibility on the doctor. The doctor, if he is allowed to, or under this doctrine that Mr. Aiken proposes, have to review the conduct of all the nurses or techs in the operating room, he may take his focus away from his primary responsibility, which is actually performing that procedure.
No, but under the way I posited it anyway, at least the doctor would make sure that there was adequate financial responsibility by people involved.
I don't know if that's the doctor's responsibility to make sure that the nurses have adequate insurance or that the hospital has adequate coverage for the people that are at the hospital. I think that's the hospital's decision or the legislature to determine whether nurses should have a certain amount of insurance when working in hospitals.
But the patient, as Mr. Aiken has said, the patient has chosen that doctor. And it strikes me that, you know, what the rule that you're advocating is sort of you first, no, you go, no, you go, no, you go, and eventually nobody's responsible. And the poor patient who is sitting there with the wrong arm cut off or whatever has no recovery.
I don't think there's any situation under the present law where the patient isn't able to recover against somebody.
When I look at today's figures and I see $50,000 municipal liability limit, that to me is next to nothing.
Right. But if you impose that type of liability where a doctor is going to be responsible for all the techs or nurses in an operating room in a municipal hospital, sooner or later, doctors aren't going to work at municipal hospitals because they may get nailed with liability from somebody else in this case. So you're going to have doctors walking away from municipal hospitals and joining other hospitals who have enough insurance so individuals won't go after them because there's a cap imposed.
Is that wrong?
I think if you take away municipal hospitals, obviously you're affecting the population. I mean, people count on municipal hospitals in their area. If doctors aren't going to go there, doctors they want to treat with, and they're only able to go to this municipal hospital, I think you're causing them a hardship.
Then the observation that this is only really going to affect the municipal hospital because the others in the private hospital would have ample insurance and we'd be going after the hospital.
And that's the population that the municipal hospitals predominantly serve.
I don't know. I suspect in like rural areas and so forth that there's a hospital, there's a municipal hospital, or a city, inner city or so forth, where there's a municipal hospital.
How about the poor and the underinsured or uninsured?
Correct.
I mean, this has ripple effects.
They don't want to go that way, but yes, you're right.
Widows and orphans?
Widows, orphans, blind, crippled,
The theory that we got into, or at least some got into on the captain of the ship doctrine, was because of the doctrine of charitable immunity.
Correct.
So it seems as if now, because you have a doctrine of limited municipal liability, you ought to go back to the old tried and true captain of the ship doctrine. I mean, that's the point. It started in order to give recovery, for negligence. And now you got a situation where you can't get recovery not because of charitable immunity, but the same kind of doctrine of limited charitable immunity.
I think we're dealing with two different issues. I mean, if this is a cap problem, we deal with the cap.
Well, but that was the cap problem under charitable immunity. The cap was zero. Now we have just upped the cap to 50,000.
But in the cases where they had capped in the ship, why they imposed the doctrine, now it wasn't because there was a limited amount of funds, but because there is no ability for this individual to recover against anybody. What we have here is an ability to recover from someone, just so happens in certain cases may not be enough funds. And I said, there may be a public policy problem with that, as you may have doctors, good doctors, going away from municipal hospitals because they may be liable for nurses, techs, and so forth at municipal hospitals who perform their jobs negligently.
Okay, I'm going to try and get at it a different way.
Okay.
If I had to go in for surgery, I would really like to know that there's one person in that room who is in charge, to whom everybody else is responsible, and then she is directing what happens. And therefore, I think that if that's true, then I think people might, if they're asked, would say, yeah, I don't want 10 people in there, each of whom is the in charge of their own little section, and that no one is calling the shots as a totality. If that's true, then shouldn't the law recognize that and make people responsible on that basis?
I think what the law should do is place the negligence with the negligent party. If I'm going into surgery, I want to make sure that my doctor is concentrating on the surgery. I don't want him concentrating on a duty that's been delegated, not delegated, a duty assigned to a nurse.
Who puts in the sponges? Is Mr. Aiken right?
The doctor puts in the sponges.
Who takes them out?
The doctor does.
Okay. I have a difficult time understanding why if the doctor was responsible for taking him out. There's no negligence when the doctor fails to take one out. But I can also understand that somebody ought to check on the doctor. Being checked on is a good technique to make sure that there's no error, because all of us can make a mistake.
I think that's correct. But under the standard of care, if we've gone further in this case, doctors would have said, the possibility of leaving a sponge in a wound is there, especially when you're dealing with the intestines. The sponges can get sucked under and you can't see them. They turn the color of blood. That is why you have the sponge count. They count them before they go in, they count them during the surgery, and they count them when they come out. The doctors... they're doing is packing off the intestines and so forth.
Does the doctor say, is your count correct?
Yes, and in this case, that's what happened. And it's standard of care for doctors to rely on the nurses when they turn to them and say, do we got all the sponges and instruments? And they go, yes. So the doctor should be able to rely on an independent professional doing their own duty in order to help him out in what he's focusing on, and that is removing a gallbladder, doing catheterization or a bypass. I think if you start making him responsible for more areas in the operating room, he may take his attention off what he's doing when he sees somebody over there, dropping a sponge or something like that or doing something else. His focus should be on the surgery itself and what's happening and what he's doing, not on whether the nurses are counting the sponges or what they're doing behind them. So I think if you take Mr. Aiken's theory and apply it or adopt it, we're going to cause all sorts of havoc for physicians as well as hospitals.
The law in numerous instances places liability or responsibility on a non-negligent party. I mean, constructing a Ford car, we routinely hold Ford responsible for somebody's mistake on the line. This is nothing new.
True. But I think when we talked earlier with Justice Bradley, that's under the certain doctrines that we have, which is respondeat superior, borrowed servants. What we're talking here about is an ability to recover, and we have that under the law as presently stated. No one goes without the ability to recover in a situation like this. If we have a situation where we have, you know, two individuals involved in a negligent act, we can use the doctrine of respondeat superior, or the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, in order to hold those two parties presumably negligent until they're able to either rebut that or not. So allowing this new theory is doing us nothing other than confusing the law and providing...
Is it really recovery if your damages are $500,000 or $700,000 and all you can recover is $50,000, as the case here? Is that... I mean, you use the word recovery, but that's a relative term in these situations.
Well, you could probably ask that question of anybody who's got an injury that's beyond the wrongful death cap, or that falls in a hospital and is injured more than $50,000. You know, recovery is the ability to get something back. What you're talking about is the amount. So the court has found in different areas the ability to limit those amounts and not affect liability. So I think they should do the same in here, and I think that's what we're doing with the municipal cap.
Was there anything in the stipulation of facts in this case about the doctor's right of control over the nurses?
No. No.
Just what? About their obligation to do the counting?
Yeah. It was their obligation under the administrative code, as well as the hospital policy, to count and oversee. The doctor, we didn't attach the testimony, but the doctor in his deposition indicated, I don't supervise their count. I don't tell them how to count. I don't tell them when to count. In fact, I suspect if the doctor said, listen, you're taking too much time. I don't want you to count more than twice, once when it goes in and once when it goes out. If the hospital policy says they have to count during surgery, the nurses will still probably count during surgery because it's hospital policy, and if they didn't, they'd get in trouble. So they have an independent duty from the hospital to do their counts, not something that the doctor...
Right. No, I understand it, but I guess I'm curious about why, if vicarious liability, and I think this is correct, depends upon the agency idea or principle of right of control, master over servant, whether or not there's an employment relationship. Why wasn't that the subject matter of the stipulation of facts?
You just didn't put it in there. I'm sure we could have if we wanted to, but we didn't get to that point. But the right of control in this particular instance, I mean, we have the hospitals who are now looking for accreditation from certain agencies that have to have policies and procedures and protocols in place which protect patients. Protocols and procedures such as the one that we have in this case, where we have counting of sponges that are done by nurses. And in fact, the administrative code recognizes that obligation and places it on the circulating nurse.
Here, counsel, the doctor put it in, is that correct?
Correct.
Does the doctor have a non-delegable duty to make sure that it's taken out?
I think the doctor has an obligation to make sure that all that goes in should come out.
So what's the answer to my question? Does the doctor have a non-delegable duty to make sure that it's taken out?
I suspect that it's standard of care that the doctor should make sure that all instruments and sponges come out of surgery.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know if I'd call it a non-delegable duty.
I use that phrase because recently, 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago, the Nebraska Supreme Court had a case, Long versus Hacker. Long was the plaintiff, happens to be a doctor himself who has some problems. Are you familiar with that case?
No.
And it actually discusses... or is discussed in law review articles as a continuation of the captain of the ship doctrine. But in that case, the doctor, Hacker, what a name. Anyway, he was operating on the back. He was in the operating room, and he and he was looking, he wasn't sure if it was L3, L4, L4, L5 he should be doing something with. So he has an x-ray taken, and the radiologist reads the x-ray outside of the operating room. The technician brings it back in and says, doctor, he says it's L4, L5. The doctor does L4, L5, and lo and behold, that ends up to be the wrong area, and there's... And there, the Nebraska Supreme Court held that the doctor, even though it was the radiologist who apparently misread it, and even though the radiologist wasn't in the same room with the doctor, that the doctor had a non-delegable duty, responsibility, or ultimate liability for proper performance, and that can't be delegated. And as I said, law review articles have said this is a continuation of the captain of the ship doctrine with regard to the medical care. So why shouldn't we say the doctor has a, like you just said, the doctor has a non-delegable duty to make sure that that's taken out?
I think what we're talking about is a standard of care in practicing medicine. If the standard of care in Nebraska is that the doctor should read the x-ray to determine where the problem is prior to surgery.
And by the way, the jury initially found in that case, I can't remember if it was retried or not, found that Dr. Hacker wasn't negligent.
If he's relying on another doctor?
It may have been retried, I can't remember. Anyway.
I have a problem with that case. In this instance, much like a family practitioner, if you say, listen, my patient's in the hospital, he's having lung problems, I have a pulmonologist consult coming in. The pulmonologist comes in, does his job, walks away, and there ends up being a lung problem that the pulmonologist missed, I don't think you can say that the family practitioner is vicariously liable for the pulmonologist. The family practitioner calls in that doctor because he has a special expertise that this guy does not have, family practitioners. So you can't...
I'll tell you, I think the doctor has a non-delegable duty. This, I'm in charge here. I put in these. I have a non-delegable duty to make sure they're taken out. Now, maybe the specific counting is administered and prescribed under rule to be done by the nurses, and maybe the nurses were negligent in their counting. But the umbrella duty seems to me to be of the doctor to make sure it's taken out.
If the legislature or the courts had indicated that there's a non-delegable duty that the doctor has to get out all the instruments and sponges, if he delegates that to someone else and they do it incorrectly, he's still liable because he has that non-delegable duty.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't that what happened here? If he has a non-delegable duty to make sure it's taken out?
I don't think it's a non-delegable duty to take it out. I think it's a standard of care to make sure that everything's out.
I maybe misunderstood you. I thought that after I kind of pushed you, you answered yes, he had a non-delegable duty to
do it. No, I still think it's a standard of care question. And standard of care in those procedures is also that they can rely on a nurse and their counts to make sure that all the sponges are out. Because what happens there is that they're able to focus on their surgery as opposed to just counting what sponges come in and out. So if, in fact, Wisconsin Administrative Code, instead of saying the circulating nurse had that duty, said that the doctor had the duty to count the sponges, I don't think he can delegate that to the nurse. But that's not what happened here. We have a Wisconsin Administrative Code section that says that the circulating nurse has that duty, as well as the hospital's policies and procedures.
So the situation in this case was that in light of the hospital procedures and the administrative code provisions, there was no expert witness who would testify that it was a violation of the standard of care in this case, or that there was a violation of the standard of care on the part of the doctor. Is that the situation?
We had a witness which said that. And I don't know about Mr. Aiken's witnesses, but we had a witness that would say it is the standard of care for physicians to rely on nurses, especially circulating nurses, to count sponges that go in and out because their focus is supposed to be on the patient and what they're doing. I mean, if they're in a tough situation where someone's blood pressure is dropping, having problems breathing, they're going, one, three, you know, how many sponges did I put in?
I understand that, but it's a matter of litigation strategy and how you set up the theory of the case. I mean, it could have been tried along the lines that Justice Bradley is suggesting, that the doctor had a duty here and the nurses had a duty here, and we'll compare their level of negligence one against the other and see how it comes out on 100% comparison. And then you got both targets as far as recovery and collectability is concerned. That was one way to try this case, right? If there was an expert witness who would say that was a violation of the standard of care.
Right, but in that particular instance, then you're talking about the direct negligence of the doctor.
Well, I understand that, but that's one way this case could have gone if there was an expert witness who was willing to come in and say, yeah, the nurses had these obligations, but the doctor also had this obligation, and he violated the standard of care, and it could have been submitted to the jury that way on a special verdict form.
Absolutely. They could have had a doctor come in and say, listen, it is the standard of care for physicians to make sure that all instruments and sponges are out of a patient.
First of all, stand in front of the microphone.
Sorry. We should just hang on.
That's for the tape recorder.
Yeah. So they could have done it that way, yes, and then said the nurses also had their own obligation, which was to count the sponges. You know, assess liability the way you want to, and then compare the negligence in the final verdict.
Mr. Reardon, do you agree with Mr. Aiken in terms of the fact that the doctor was the one who selected the hospital here?
I try not to agree with Mr. Aiken much, but I think that's correct. And I think in some instance, too, the hospital selects the doctor by granting them privileges. So the doctor did select this hospital at which to perform this procedure, correct? However, I still don't know how that bears on the vicarious liability aspects of the captain of the ship doctrine that we're talking here, because in this instance, the hospital is the one that hires, fires, supervises, and monitors their employees, which are the nurses in this case. They keep, I'm sure, charts and graphs on the successes of the nurses and so forth, and able to review them and make sure that they're able to get their accreditation through the various accrediting bodies for hospitals. The doctor doesn't do that. The doctor doesn't hire, fire, or supervise these nurses. He's only hoping that the hospital has done their job and that the nurses in there are capable of performing it in a capable manner.
Could I ask you, if we adopted Mr. Aiken's theory and we had the same facts, and we had a hospital without limits on liability, how would we apportion the liability in a case like that? It's the same question I asked Mr. Aiken. Did you agree with his answer?
I think that's true. If we had a hospital with unlimited funds, we had a doctrine of captain of the ship where you can either go after the hospital or after the doctor, I think you could go either way. And I don't know how you'd apportion negligence. I don't know how you'd say, listen, the hospital was negligent through their employees under this doctor, and the doctor was negligent because he's the captain of the ship or just standing there performing the surgery. I don't know how you'd apportion negligence. I don't know how you'd tell a jury this doctor should be 85%, the nurses should be 15. I suspect the jury would probably split it right down the middle and go 50-50.
Well, it's really not a matter of apportionment at all, is it? It's a matter of joint and several vicarious liability.
Or pick your poison. I mean, as Mr. Aiken said, he'd probably just go after the hospital. But I think this case comes down to the ability for a patient to recover, and under the present state of the law, they are able to recover under all the situations that we have present. We don't need a new law of vicarious liability such as captainship. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Riordan. Mr. Aiken, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. I would direct the court's attention to the product liability law. There's a non-delegable duty to sell a non-defective product. The manufacturer or anybody in the chain can be held responsible, and that's the plaintiff's burden. But the second part of every product liability case is a comparison of the negligence of the parties in creating the defect. And it's entirely possible and even probable in many product cases that a party who is
responsible either under vicarious liability, non-delegable duty, whatever surname one gives product liability, is zero at fault. Standard of care, that's a negligence question. Vicarious liability, non-delegable duty is not a negligence question. And so, in the typical situation, although the doctor may be responsible, he is not negligent, or she is not negligent, as the case may be. That's the first point I wanted to make. Second point is, although Moore and some of the cases refer to good treatment, and I see where you were going, Justice Sykes, in malpractice law, good treatment is not the standard. Good treatment may be to do five x-rays, but standard of care may be to do one. So again, there's a distinguishing factor in these cases when they refer to good treatment, because one might say, and I think it would be hard to debate, that Dr. Scalera, good treatment or care would be for him to count the sponges too, but that isn't the standard of care. So what I'm asking the court to do is enforce the prior cases that basically, I don't care how you read the cases we cited, but they're either non-delegable duty, vicarious liability. Or imputed liability. That's the second point I want to make. Third point is, and I tried to clear this up in the beginning, respondeat superior is not limited to employment situations. And when we make reference to the one case that wasn't employment, we say they mistakenly said respondeat superior, what we should have said is that by using that term, they clouded that decision, which is why I haven't cited it. But respondeat superior actually just means let the superior respond, and we quote at page 21 of our brief that that one name is vicarious liability, one name is imputed negligence, and one is respondeat superior, quoting Prosser. And also, this theory of vicarious liability under section 69, it's imputed because by reason of some relation, Prosser says, existing between A and B, some relation. The negligence of A is to be charged against B, although B has played no part in it, that's an answer to Justice Wilcox's question, has done nothing whatsoever to aid it or encourage it, or indeed has done all that he possibly can do to prevent it. All that he possibly can do to prevent it. That's the law of vicarious liability.
And what's the relationship that would sustain the application of vicarious liability here and the control of the level?
The doctor-patient relationship established by the patient with the doctor deciding surgery.
Doesn't this refer to the relationship between the person who is negligent and the person against whom?
Indeed, but the relationship is a triangle with the patient at the bottom, and the relationship between the two is that the doctor is having nurses assist him in getting sponges, getting instruments. But ultimately, there's no rule that there has to be a doctor has to do a surgery with a nurse. A doctor could do a surgery with another doctor, or he could do it alone.
Is there a rule that there has to be some level or right of control before vicarious liability can be imposed?
No, I don't believe that's what Prosser says. He says by reason of some relation. And we know there doesn't have to be control for some theories of vicarious liability. We see it in the Wisconsin case law. And we also see it in situations such as I said in the pamphlet situation, where other types of vicarious liability were allowed for various and differing reasons. But control would make the person an agent, and then rules of agency would apply, and we again wouldn't be here. It has to be some relationship, and I submit the relationship is the patient relying upon the doctor and the doctor using the nurses to assist him in performing his operation. And I mean, he has decided to have assistance in his operation and to use the hospital in his operation. And as I said, there is no absolute rule of medicine because you could never have an emergency surgery. And the level of expertise of those nurses is something the doctor decides to rely or not rely upon. And I would caution that this rule that I guess the court feels I'm asking for an extension, I don't think I am. I don't think it's any different than if I have an outside paralegal keeping track of my statutes of limitations. And I blame that paralegal and say, hey, you know, I delegate it. I get some mercy. That's a standard of care.
Are doctors going to be less willing to practice at municipal hospitals or to perform surgery at municipal hospitals if we rule for you?
I don't think that could ever be the case in a state with unlimited insurance. The doctors are not personally liable in the state for medical malpractice. The statutes are clear. It's totally an insurance issue. With the underlying insurer now having $1 million and the fund being the excess, there is no personal liability by any physician. I think more importantly, I'd like to look at the other side. Every one of these caps and every one of these situations affect the poor and the elderly the most. In a case like this, if you limit recovery to $50,000, they're not going to get $50,000. They're going to get nothing. Because I can't afford as a malpractice lawyer to take the case. I barely can afford to take a case that's worth $350,000. It's questionable. A case like this can cost me $50,000 to $100,000 out of my pocket. Why would I take a case worth $50,000 or $350,000? I mean, you're barring these people from the courthouse. And you have to recognize that these type of cases, this type of law just deprives these people of their rights totally, not partially. I think my time is up.
Thank you,
Mr. Aiken, if you prevail here, the hospital and the nurses have already been dismissed out of the case. Could you kind of clarify what would happen when you go back to court?
Well, by virtue of our stipulation, we've agreed that the judgment has been entered, and the months has been escaping me, but it would be over. The case would be over. Dr. Sklar's insurer would pay, because the cap applies in this case to the doctor as much as it applies to us. So all that would happen is that we've agreed that if the court goes either my new way or my old way, that we win, or if I lose, then we pack our bags and go home.
You win, and what do you win?
We win the amount of the stipulated judgment. We stipulated everything in order to have this issue go up.
So if you had stipulated $700,000, that's what you would get, less the $50,000 you already got.
Correct. And obviously this case isn't as big as others could be, but it was an ideal case for this very situation, because oftentimes you can get someone to say standard of care, but standard of care and non-double duty are just too different. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Aiken. Thank you, Mr. Riordan. That concludes our hearing on 19.